This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Annie.
And Samantha.
And welcome to Stuff I Never Told You, a production of iHeartRadio.
Y'all, today is a very exciting day for me because, again, I'm bringing in the TikTok world, the social media world, where I get so much information and such good content into our podcast with the multi-talented, she's a historian, a documentarian, a musician, just overall multi-talent, so many things under her belt, Dara Starr Tucker. Yay!
Hey!
Hi!
And with that introduction, can you kind of tell our listeners about yourself?
Well, yes, you kind of said it. I'm a singer, I'm a songwriter. I think my bio says singer, songwriter, social media commentator, and satirist.
Yes.
So I try to make it a little bit alliterative so that it's easy to follow. But those are the essential things that I do. I am by trade a jazz singer, and I have gotten into the social media space in the last 3 years or so on TikTok and now Instagram, Facebook. I'm, you know, just everywhere these days, kind of sharing my thoughts and feelings about pop culture, but then how race and culture kind of intersect and intermingle with, you know, all of the things that we spend our time consuming. And so then that's sort of veers into a little bit of the media literacy territory, which I love. And then I've shared some of my so-called deconstruction journey out of traditional religion. I've shared some of that type of content. So yeah, I do a lot of things. A lot of things.
There's so much, and I love it. I'm not going to lie. Again, I'm so excited because I've been following you for a while now, and your TikTok is so original. The content that you produce and come out with is so thought-provoking and original, and it's just something that I feel like could be passed on to my conservative family, that they would actually listen and have so much to think on, because you give so much good context and information. But on top of that, you are so talented. Your rendition of Moon River, it was gorgeous. It was gorgeous. So yes, I obviously... and fangirling a little bit because you are a woman of so many talents.
Thank you so much.
I know you have so much that you can tell us. And yeah, I'm going to go ahead and give our listeners a warning, because you do have such great content. There's so many questions that we have. There's so many things that we want to ask you and get your opinions and expertise, because again, have so much on your page, whether it is all this information of historical stuff or your satire of your mother.
And my her favorite. Opinions.
I love it so much. It's so, so good. But yeah, just listeners be warned. If you've listened to the show before, you know me as the person who jumps all around anyway, but I'm super excited and you have so much. So yeah, that's probably going to happen here.
And hopefully, as I say, with my content, I hope that it lives together well. I think it does. Ultimately does.
I think you get so much goodness with a little bit of break of like education, as well as you got that break for funniness, as well as that beautiful music. I'm like, yeah,
thank
of course.
You so much.
And then we're going to talk a little more about it later, but you're also a podcaster too. So
yes.
Obviously you're part of the fam. Right?
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, when it comes to your content, speaking of, how do you balance the education with the openness of your own personal experiences, as well as highlighting your career? How do you balance all of that?
Just the variety of content you're asking about.
Yeah, you're so much.
Honestly, I try, it's going to sound really corny, but I try to lead with the heart. I really do. And I think, you know, until your content becomes corporatized, for lack of a better word, you can do that. You can say, what type of content do I feel like creating today? And you can just create that. And that's the best part of what I do, is that it really is an expression of all of these various parts of me. You know, I wrestled and wrangled with myself, even to get into the social media commentator space, because I am a singer. You know, that was a challenge, you know, in 2020. It was like, I really wanted to speak out and I had so much to say. And it was like, well, people only know me as this. They really only know me as a singer. And are they going to accept me doing something else? And I had a real fear. I had a real concern about even expressing that part of myself. But then, you know, I led with the heart when it came to entering that space. And that is really the thing. I don't know how I quite feel about that, but that's the thing, rather than my music, that has represented, you know, this kind of explosion into the, you know, the social media space, where a lot of people now know who I am. And so I just kind of have to take my cues from that. It's like there was a leading, there was a guiding, there was an unction, to use these religious words, that told me, like, hey, this is your path, this is what you're supposed to do. And so I try to lead with that no matter what I do. And I have had literal social media management companies, you know, say, hey, we would be able to work with you if you were to just post this one kind of thing, if you were to just do this one thing. Like, you're adding the music and the comedy and this stuff is cool. And, you know, some people are enjoying it, but they're not finding it like they're finding these breakdowns. So, you know, if you could just focus on this one thing, then, you know, that could open you up to be able to get all of these sponsorships. And I cannot subject myself to that type of limitation, because I know that that would be stifling to me. So I just enjoy what I do. And if things get too heavy and too intense with talking about things like racism and, you know, that kind of thing, then I can just do a sketch about my mom, like you said.
So wish you're wonderful.
And then I'm happy again.
And that's so interesting, because we know when it comes to social media, when it gets too bleak, it's a lot of work. And and one of the things that I know, as we've come on to podcasting about feminism and women's issues and marginalized issues, it gets heavy very quickly. And our listeners will take that, I guess, are a part of that. But they also love the parts that we are really personal and breaking down the realities of who we are. And that means seeing our sense of humor and seeing our backgrounds and seeing what we love. So boo on the social media people. They're wrong.
Right.
Tell them that, okay?
Tell them
and
so
I appreciate all that content.
Thank you. I appreciate it. That's the coolest thing, when people come along to a post of me singing or a post of me doing some silly sketch about, you know, I have a character called Shelby's mom who just stands
hilarious.
At the door and yammers at her daughter about being too woke and, you know, all of this silly stuff. But it's really cool when people know me for, you know, these breakdowns that talk about, you know, whatever racial inequity and these deep cultural issues. And then they see this ridiculous thing that I'm posting here. I'm, you know, putting on a wig and playing my mother and just being just utterly silly. And they're like, what? Weren't you the same person who was just talking about, you know, whatever it is, gerrymandering yesterday? Right. And they're like, oh, well, this is really cool. But it takes a minute, I think, sometimes for people to kind of go, what, you know, what, huh? And then if they can embrace the totality of who you are and what you have to offer, then just, you know, they just relax into it. Then it just becomes like, oh, okay, well, this is, you know, what she's doing today. This is somebody that I appreciate and who has a voice that I, you know, want to pay attention to. I appreciate her perspective, whatever she's doing. And I'm just kind of here for it. That's the coolest thing for me.
And we do appreciate it.
Thank you.
But yes, you are a celebrated award-winning musician, and you do share your love of music with your followers, including like a lot of really behind-the-scenes stuff that's really cool, like on episodes on women around like Martha Mears or Marnie Nixon, like ghost singers. It's really, really fascinating. So when you look at the history of women like these, what are some of the things that you find the most fascinating, and why do you think that stories like those are so important to tell?
Well, I mean, you mentioned Marnie Nixon, who is who was known as Hollywood's, you know, greatest ghost singer. She did singing for Natalie Wood in West Side Story. She sang for, I believe, Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady, and Deborah Carr in The King and I. And she was kind of known as this, you know, person behind the scenes that was known by Hollywood, but wasn't known by the general public. And it was like one of those kind of open secrets that these actresses were not really singing for themselves. And then you have someone like Martha Wash, who did the singing for the song, you know, Everybody Dance Now, the CNC Music Factory. And that was one of my biggest videos last year. That's where a lot of people came to know who I am because of talking about her. But she's a plus size Black woman who did this hook, this very famous hook, and sang on a bunch of other stuff that people know, like house music, and was kind of under-acknowledged. So I think when, you know, we're talking about women like this who have been kind of the voice behind the voice for women that were perceived as more attractive, more palatable for the general public, and who never got their just due, I think there's a point of identification that a lot of people have with that, because you know, who among us has not felt like, well, if I just had this, if I just, you know, if I were just more this or less that or whatever, then people would see me. They would see my talent. They would see my beauty. They would know that I have all of these things to offer. I think we've all felt that way to some degree, boxed in by life, boxed in by expectations, especially if you have a career in media in any respect, or have aspired to have a career in media. So I think there's just, those stories feel very personal. I think any story that I do, and I tend to be attracted to those stories about people who were cast aside or who were not given something that they maybe should have had. I did a story on a man named Eric Monte, who was a Black man who wrote for a couple of Norman Lear shows and who felt that he was cheated out of a lot of the credit and the profits that he should have had. And those stories really spark, you know, something in people. It's just this, and I have gotten flooded with people reaching out saying the same thing happened to me and I did this. And, you know, this credit was taken away from me. It's just a universal topic, I think, that just, it just hits a lot of people very, very viscerally.
It's true. And, you know, speaking of, one of the most famous incidents inside my lifetime, outside of the Milli Vanilli controversy, of course, is the CNC Music Factory controversy. I remember when that all came out and everybody was like, that was not her singing with Martha Wash. Again, you do an amazing breakdown of that incident, and it really highlights the prejudice within the industry. She's a plus-size Black woman, and they were trying to kind of hide her. Do you think the prejudices is still present today in the music industry?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think all it would take is just kind of seeing what is amplified, what is celebrated. I mean, people always point to like Lizzo, oh, but we have Lizzo now. Yeah. And it's great that we do. And it's great that there are other plus size heroes that we have that we can look to, because it certainly is better than it was when I was young. But I don't think it has changed that much. I think we have some very important exceptions that are out there. But I think, you know, those same rules still apply. And I think people will always be drawn to what they feel is beautiful. And those in power will always be in the position to define what that is. And so I don't think that that will ever fully go away. But I'm thankful that there are some very important exceptions, that there is a body positivity and body acceptance movement that is much more mainstream than it was even 10 years ago. So we can't deny that there has been progress. But oh yeah, that those standards still exist today.
Right.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, and going into deeper conversations about like misogynoir within both hip hop and both R&B, do you think that that is being spoken out more recently, maybe because of Megan Thee Stallion, or is it just the same as it was and we're just knowing a word? Does that question make sense?
I think, you know, I think there have always been those folks who have been willing to talk about that and, you know, have been just speaking out about a variety of topics. It's just funny because now there's TikTok, now there's social media, and now we have a community of people who can get together and say, oh, wait, you noticed that? I noticed that too. And this is my point of view, and this is how I experience it. And this is the thing that I noticed that maybe other people didn't get this kind of nuanced thing about. So that's the beauty of where we are now, is that we are having national conversations that everyone can participate in. And so I think we can help to move the ball forward at a much faster rate, at least amongst people who give a crap. you know, and there's always going to be that element of people who just, you know, deny that there's a problem or are actively participating in perpetuating those problems. But yeah, I think it's really cool that conversations about misogynoir in hip hop and R&B are happening. But I, you know, I think the problem, it feels to me that the problem is has not really gotten much better, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah. Well, something else we wanted to talk about. You also did a really cool breakdown on the Elvis movie and the amazing musician Big Mama Thornton. Can you talk about that and her life and her contributions?
Big Mama Thornton, yeah. She put out Hound Dog in 1952, and it was written by Lieber and Stoller. These are two Jewish guys who wrote this song, this incredible blues song for her. They wrote this for Big Mama Thornton, and she was a blues singer who was just, she was plus size black woman, just big body. I mean, you know, when you hear her version of Hound Dog, it's just, it's unlike if you have never heard her original version of it. It's just, it's so completely unlike Elvis Presley's version. But there were a couple of groups that covered Hound Dog after her. And I'm thinking it was Freddie and the Freeloaders that did a version of it that Elvis ended up hearing. And then he later covered it, as did many people. But of course, his version became the iconic version that most people know. Big Mama Thornton's version was a hit in 1952. So it wasn't as though, you know, she got absolutely no recognition from it, but she did not make a lot of money from it. It was definitely relegated to the R&B world, which at that time would have been called race music. It was not played on mainstream radio. And she did not become some, you know, international phenomenon in the way that Elvis Presley did for recording Hound Dog. So, you know, the whole Elvis Presley conversation just is, it's just, it's one of the topics, I think, that gets the most feedback in the comments. Yeah, he's one of those people that just will always have just avid fans that feel the need to jump to his defense. And, you know, my feelings about Elvis are very complex. I am actually an Elvis fan. I mm-hmm. like Elvis Presley. And mm-hmm. that is almost a curse that's like a scarlet letter right. In the black community. You just don't say that. And I don't say it that much, but occasionally I will cop to being a huge Elvis fan growing up. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to examine questions of, and I think you were speaking of the breakdown that I did on the subject of cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. But it's important to talk about topics like that. And Elvis just being, you know, just the number one representative of the idea of cultural appropriation, whether that's deserving or not, he just was the most famous. He was the one that benefited from it more than anyone.
Right.
Even if he personally was not necessarily antagonistic in his treatment of black people. There were a lot of black musicians that actually appreciated him mm-hmm. and they embraced him and they thought he was talented. But then there's the other side of things where, you know, he essentially took his sound from a black man named Roy Hamilton. If people mm-hmm. are not aware of who Roy Hamilton is, just take some time to look him up on YouTube and you will know where Elvis's sound came from. There was a writer named Otis Blackwell that Elvis ended up getting partial credit for writing All Shook Up and a couple of other songs that Otis Blackwell wrote. And Elvis sounds an awful lot like him, too. There's a mm-hmm. performance of his that's on YouTube where you can hear, you know, hear what he would have sounded like singing the demo for Elvis. So, you know, it's a multi-layered thing. And no, I didn't like the Elvis movie, if that's what you were specifically asking about. I did not like it.
I will say I've never seen it. Yeah, saying that we're Elvis fans, I felt guilty because I actually did watch all of his movies as a kid. I loved
wow.
musicals.
Wow.
I loved
yeah,
all the things. and then looking back, it's like even feminist, you're like, oh man, he dated young babies and that is real gross. Like right. looking at him historically, you're like, he is not a good dude.
Yeah,
but it's kind of that whole conversation in, like, music is the prime example of cultural appropriation slash stealing an erasure of Black history, which we know the origination did come from the Black community. Like, we know all of music, where it came down to it, is taken from one culture. When we talk about this, how do we do this in a respectful way where we... Yes, we like some of these music. K-pop is one of those things that I think about too, because right now that's a point in terms. Yes, this is cultural appropriation to an extent. And so the kind of like that fine balance of like, how do we learn to appreciate at this and acknowledge the origination, but still like these maybe problematic things?
Yeah, I did, as I said, a breakdown called, you know, cultural appropriation versus appreciation, which that's been one of the more popular ones that I've done, because I think... You know, these are subjects that if you just look them up in the, you know, the encyclopedia definition or the dictionary definition, you can, you know, draw one conclusion, but they are nuanced subjects that really have to be discussed sometimes on a case by case basis. And it's not always, the answers are not always straightforward. The lines are not always black and white. No pun intended, but you know, these conversations have to be had amongst people who are deeply plugged into the culture and are deeply aware of his historical context. And I think when you remove, especially something like K-pop from its historical context, then it's, you know, well, why are you guys getting so upset over this? Well, people borrow from each other all the time. And, you know, it's, people exchange cultures and ideas, and Black people have taken this, and it just becomes, you know, a big wash. It's just like, well, why are you mincing over such silly things until you really step back and start to examine the history, as you said, of where a lot of, you know, the music that we call just popular music, where that really originated. And I did another video called Who Invented Rock and Roll? And it's literally just a delineation, just a kind of a linear delineation of the history of rock and roll. And there's just so much that we take for granted. We just kind of assume that certain things rose up from the earth and that they're just here, because when, you know, by the time we got here, it was all here. It was like we were just all kind of partying and hanging out and enjoying what we were enjoying. And you don't really think about the roots of it. So I think it's important, me being a musician, that when you enter into that sphere, regardless of the kind of music that you're doing, that you really do take time to become a student of music history, of the history of the culture or the environment in which you are creating that art. And it's hard for young kids. If you're 14, 15, 16 years old and you're a K-pop artist, or you're someone who enjoys K-pop, it takes time to really become a scholar. It takes time to become knowledgeable about these things. So I just have to remember, you know, where I was at 14 or 15 years old. I didn't know, you know, I barely knew anything that I know now. But I think we have to emphasize education, and that's, you know, just in terms of musicality, just period. I think our music would be better if people were better educated about music. And I think that musical expressions would be much more respectful and much more meaningful if people were educated about the history of where their music came from. And so, you know, you cannot force the curiosity. You can't force people to care about something. We have to keep talking about these things and hopefully causing, you know, sparking conversations. And, you know, there's so much, I'll just use the word ignorance. There's so much ignorance out there around this stuff. And it's things that I take for granted, that it's like, oh, well, you know, everyone knows that rock and roll originated in the Black community. Everybody knows that rock and roll started with Jump Blues, and Jump Blues came from the blues, and that this was something that was developed in the South by Black musicians who, you know, who had nothing and they were poor. And, you know, everyone knows this, but no, everyone doesn't know this. Full grown people don't know this. You know, it's just not something that's commonly discussed. So, yeah, I think we have to become, you know, as curious as possible, especially as artists and musicians.
Right. And with you tackling these large topics, such as history and music and all of that, I know you have your fair share of trolls who have to come through. How do you deal with that? That's the question I have to ask all of the social media creators. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's bad. It's bad. There's a lot of negativity in the comments. I can't say that I'm an expert on how to deal with it. When I first started, because my first huge video about the Aunt Jemima controversy, and that was bad. It was like a couple of years ago. Actually, this month they were getting ready to come up on probably the second or third, I guess the third anniversary of that video. That Aunt Jemima should not be whatever on the cover of a pancake box. And that was the worst. And when that first video first blew up, it was just flooded. It was flooded by just hatred, just vitriolic racism. It was terrible. And all of this over a pancake box that supposedly, according to a lot of these people, was just inconsequential. It shouldn't matter. What's the big deal? But then, you know, it's igniting all of this fury. And so, which is obviously coming from some place other than being upset about the branding changing on their pancake mix. But at first, I think I felt obligated to be super gracious and to keep up this sort of dignified appearance. I had someone, I'm just now starting to post this stuff in the last year or so on Facebook. So my Facebook is kind of just catching up with a lot of my other social media. And of course you have an older audience over there. And I had someone comment, you know, cause I had clapped back at someone. And he said, well, you should be more professional. Oh, you should be ashamed. You should be more professional. I said, why should I be more professional? I have no obligation to be professional in the comments, you know, with the way that some people come at me. No, I do not feel an obligation towards professionalism. I do not represent an organization. I don't represent any sort of a company or any corporate interest of any kind. I'm a human being who is sharing knowledge. And if people choose to be disrespectful, then I can handle that in any way that I choose. Now, I don't curse people out. I don't call people names generally if they are behaving in a particular way. I may say, well, this is this. You are exhibiting this. And I will call a thing a thing. But I don't, you know, I don't call people out of their name. So I've kind of relinquished myself of the need to be anything other than what I actually am. And I want people to know this is a different philosophy than a lot of people will uphold, which is if you feel the need to clap back at somebody in that moment, say what you have to say, because holding on to that and just internalizing that and allowing it to just fester and grow, that is extremely unhealthy. So I've started, you know, people will come back and say, well, you need to just rise above it and take the high road and, you know, don't worry about these trolls. You're above them and you really shouldn't. No, absolutely not. That approach was making me, it was just making me crazy. It really was. And it's like, no, you have the right to respond. If you choose to, in that moment, you have the right to respond. Now, the other side of that is we have to protect our energy. And if you do not have inclination or time to engage with people who are sea lioning or who are time wasters or who are being completely out of pocket and disrespectful and who are not interested in any sort of real intellectual exchange, you know, I know how to block and delete, and I spend some time blocking and deleting. But if, you know, if someone comes in and says, hey, this information is incorrect and you're wrong and you are this, you know, those personal attacks. And if I feel the need to respond, I will do that. I have absolutely no problem responding. And I have relinquished the need to protect any sort of reputation or image that anyone has of me. Because if your image of me was that I would not respond to you, well, then you're going to get a wake-up call today. You're going to get some new information to take with you.
I love it. And you know what? Your clapbacks have always been gracious, like with the more like education.
Thank you.
Which is more than they deserve. Like it really has been.
Thank you for acknowledging that.
I was always impressed. I acknowledge every bit of that because I'm like, okay, you look at that. Because you literally come back with, let me help you in your ignorance with this more information. And I'm like, all right, she's got this.
Right.
So yes, I think it's gracious.
Right.
And I love how you're talking about energy and space, because we did come up on your article, the 2016 Huffington Post article, Here's to the Ladies Who Cuss.
Wow,
aren't they a blast?
Interesting.
I loved it. Which aligns with a lot about what we talk about learning to take up space or being, just being there and being in the space and not being apologetic about it.
Yes.
And also you do talk about religion, which we really want to get into, because that is something that has haunted myself. And I think Annie would say that too, where we have been so traumatized about what being a godly good woman meant, which oftentimes meant being little.
Yes.
And in that article you write, "But as a fully formed adult, I have begun to understand that it is not only my option, but my obligation to occupy that space," which, you know, I love this. Brings me to this question, how did you get to that point? How were you able to say this in that moment of like, I am finally ready, or I finally acknowledge this is what I need to do?
Oh, well, it's such a... So funny that you bring that up. That was 2016. I haven't read that article in years.
We found you.
Right. I hope you didn't find anything else that would be like incriminating for me. I don't know what all is out there.
The surprise ending of this podcast.
Expose right now.
It's been such a journey. I have to apologize in advance for using the word journey excessively, because it's just one of those cliches that I just giggle at when I hear it. But anyway, it's been a journey. Yes. to myself. And I'm sure most people, especially most women, can recognize that process. It's a lifelong progression to get to yourself, simply because, you know, if you grew up in a hyper-religious environment in the way that I did, and in the way that a lot of people did, what you're taught is to place layers on top of yourself. And those layers are placed up on you before you even begin to gain consciousness of who you are in the world. And so once I realized that my job, that was my job, that is the goal, to get to the core of who you are, that was an eye-opening point in life. It was like, oh, okay, so if I just sort of weirdly flag my nose in the face of what you are telling me that I'm supposed to be or want or do or think or say, like, I will actually find freedom and redemption and joy and peace. And wait a minute, this is weird. And it was just kind of like baby steps. And that probably started to happen in my late 20s. And it was a very kind of slow, tedious thing to sort of begin to very slowly peel off those restraints. And I'm involved in the deconstruction community on TikTok, and I've watched some people who are younger than I am and who are not at the place that I am in their deconstruction journey. And they've done this, they've undertaken this process in a matter of just, you know, a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years. You know, in 2020, at the beginning of the pandemic, they were ardent evangelicals who were attending church and leading praise and worship every Sunday. And then by 2021, a year later, they are speaking out and just doing activism in the LGBTQ community or whatever. I'm like, how in the world did you make this progression so quickly? Because for me, it was, you know, it was a period of just, it's still underway. But I mean, this was a process that started in probably my late teens of just like, you know, this is oppressive. This cloak that I have been raised under, this is an oppressive, weighty thing. And it's just a slow process of giving yourself permission to find the, you know, the truth and the core of who you are. And the genesis of that for me, and this is a very personal journey that I have been on, the real core of the work started when my parents died, and they both died in 2014. And so I noticed after that, you know, as horribly tragic and sad and difficult and, you know, just life altering that was, I started to notice that after that happened, I started to experience a different kind of freedom within myself to just be all of who I am. And, you know, that article was written in 2016. So the timing of that is not a coincidence. I wish I had given myself that permission sooner, because I feel like I really wish my parents could have seen, you know, more of the manifestation of who I am in the world. But I needed that. I needed the release that happened when they left. And so then after they passed, it was like, well, I know that speaking out and whatever, even writing that article, for goodness sake, it was like, you know, I think I ended it by saying something about not giving a bleep. I won't say that because it'll be bleeped here. And I'm not even really someone who cusses, which is hilarious to have written an article like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if my parents were around and I had written an article like that, I would have been mortified for them to see that. But, you know, once they were gone, it was like, well, aunties, uncles, cousins, friends of my parents, because my parents were ministers. My grandmother was a pastor, a Holiness Pentecostal pastor. It was like, I can deal with those tangential people being disappointed in me. I could not deal with my parents being disappointed in me. I could not deal with it. And I knew that to a degree, you know, half the decisions I was making were not ones that they would have made for me, but I just couldn't really, you know, make the leap fully until they were gone. So my whole philosophy at this point in my life now, you know, post, you know, having parents is that it is my job at times to disappoint people. That's a process that I go through daily. And I tell any woman in particular, women, this oftentimes is our hangup, but I tell younger women as often as I can, your job in life at times will be to disappoint people. You have to start to get comfortable. It's really hard, but you have to start to get comfortable with the idea of letting people down and disappointing people, because that process will never stop. It doesn't matter what you're doing. If you're trying to live up to expectations, you're going to disappoint people. If you are flagging your nose in the face of expectations, you're going to disappoint people. So if you can be proactive about that and just get ahead of it and say, no, I'm going to wake up today and realize my job is to disappoint people. If you're not disappointing somebody today, then you're not doing it right. You are not making any decisions at all if you're not disappointing somebody.
Okay, that feels like an encouragement, as my parents and I are not in the same boat on most things.
Yeah.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money, so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
the war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Is it as obvious that you are a songwriter in this post that you did? Because I want to read this. It is towards the end, but not the damn part. Which you can say damn. Apparently, that's not one of the extreme words on our. I didn't know either until I started podcasting. I was like, I can say that one, but I can't say this. Okay. But it says, in the coming year, I will be more loving and I will be kinder. I will also stake a claim in my own life. I am compelled to make room for myself. I will not always be pleasing or appropriate, but I will blossom. Again, you're obviously a poet-songwriter. That was right there in that one. I hope you're proud of your own writing. Because that's such a statement in talking about taking a stake in yourself. And as you're talking about, you know, you're going to disappoint someone. Mm-hmm. Do you feel in your journey, I'm going to say it too, in your journey, as you have blossomed, what would be the advice for young people today / the marginalized? Because we have a lot of 20-something listeners and 30-something listeners. What would be something that you would tell them in learning to take up space? How would you advise them to go forward with that?
Well, as I said, just engaging, actively engaging in the process of letting other people down. It almost sounds like negative advice, but it's positive advice. It's paradoxical. In learning how to release the expectation of always being pleasing. That's, you know, I was a church girl. I was raised to be a church girl. And I know this is not just exclusive to the church, but we were taught to be obedient. I mean, obedience was a lesson that my mother taught daily. We knew all of the scriptures around, you know, obedience is better than sacrifice, and children, obey your parents and the Lord, for this is right. And those lessons and obedience were just hammered away. And I understand, you know, my mother had 7 children. I understand why she felt the need to really, you know, turn us into these almost like robotic creatures. We were just ready to step in line, you know, at a moment's notice. I get it. But, you know, to take those attitudes into adulthood can open us up to some very dangerous situations. We were very well protected, but I can only imagine the dangers that could have existed for me if we weren't as sheltered as we were. Because to be taught to be that obedient and then to be exposed to the world, you know, there was a period of time where I had left my parents' home and I still had that mentality. And, you know, it's just, it's a really dangerous brew to just step out into the world going, okay, you know more than I do. You know better than I do. Please tell me where to stand and where to be and what to say and what to do. It's just, you know, it's unconscionable, really, when I think back on it. I'm really glad that I didn't suffer more trauma than what I did. I can't say that all of my brothers and sisters were that fortunate. You know, I don't feel that I ever suffered abuse, in true abuse, in the world, but I have siblings who did. And so we have to be self-protective, and we have to learn how to begin to draw boundaries in our own lives. And you have to set up those parameters individually. And, you know, no one can really tell you what those parameters should be. You have to make those decisions on your own. And so, unfortunately, sometimes that can leave us in a place of isolation. Maybe temporary, hopefully temporary, because permanent isolation is not, it's not healthy. But if there are periods of time in our lives where we have to remove ourselves from people who do not understand those boundaries, then you got to do it for the period of time, you know, that's necessary. I mean, I had to move away. I had to move away from my hometown and just really begin to quiet the voices, quiet all of those external voices. Because in the world, you know, in the church world, my God, there's just nonstop people yapping in your ear and wanting to tell you how things should be. Like if they could crawl in your brain,
at least they would be there.
Right. In my world, right. It was that intense. We didn't just go to church. It wasn't just some polite experience of like, we're going to put on our nice clothes and just sit here and sing a few songs and open the Bible and have encouragement and go home. It was like, no, this is like morning, noon, and night. This is this is the core of who you are. Mm-hmm. And so I had to get out. I had to remove myself, and I felt guilty, you know, at the beginning of that process. I felt guilty for leaving. Me leaving home was a traumatic experience. I had a knockdown drag out with my father that I never thought I would have in my life just from leaving. But I did it for survival. I knew that I had to do that. So, you know, you're worth fighting for, I would say. If I'm speaking to you know, Gen Z, young women, millennials, whatever, you're worth fighting for. You have to believe that. And it's not always going to be pretty. Mm-hmm. It will not always be just the most beautiful Zen experience of self-discovery, you know, wandering through the thicket. And like, no, sometimes it's like, you got to get out that sword and you got to start cutting out the, you know, the weeds and sometimes it's just ugly, but you're worth the process, and you have to believe that.
Yeah, I love that. And it kind of goes hand in hand with what you've been talking about, especially with religious trauma. We're actually working on an episode, so we're going to have to bring you back maybe for that conversation itself. Because the way that religious trauma has affected women over the past forever, and now it's kind of coming back with the whole Christian nationalist idea. Mm-hmm. We're not going all into that, but there's a lot to be said when it comes to religious trauma and what it does to marginalized people, specifically women, and those who have suffered throughout being told, you must obey, you must become a servant to A, B, C, and D. But you're also a big part of the community, because you've talked about deconstruction quite a bit now. And I love this. I love seeing this on social media, because like you, I had a huge journey in ripping myself away, because I really thought I was going to be a missionary. I was thinking that my life was to serve this way, because I had to be grateful for being quote unquote saved.
Right.
You know, that's such a thing that like plagues you. And even today, like I still can't quite let that trauma go, that feeling of I'm not grateful enough. But seeing these people coming together, yourself as well as so many others, come into this community and talking about what that looks like and learning to let that go is such a powerful tool. But
it really
can you kind of talk about that for us, and what that looks like and what that community is, and how we can be a part of it?
The deconstruction community on TikTok. This is like something I did when I started my so-called deconstruction journey. Somebody needs to put a counter up.
We know
the number.
We can make it a game somehow.
A drinking game or something.
Yeah.
A journey drinking game. You know, when I started my deconstruction process in my 20s, that word didn't even exist, not in relation to religion. Nobody was talking about deconstruction. I was just rebellious, you know, or as my grandmother, who was a Pentecostal minister, she would say rebellious. You know, if you veered off the path, you was just rebellious, you were backsliding.
Yeah,
and
backsliding.
You needed to come home, you know. And so you were in danger. That's what it was. It was like there was no organization around it at all. We knew people who had backslidden. And it was like, you know, I remember when we were very young, and we always attended Christian schools. Parents always had us in either Christian school or homeschool. But there was a man who ran like a private Christian school. It was kind of a real small school in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I was partly raised. And he we were thinking of switching, our parents were thinking of switching schools and not, you know, having us in the same school that we had mostly grown up in. And we were like, well, can we go to this other school? I think it was called Bread of Life or something like that. And I remember my father saying, well, babe, he called us babies. He called us all his babies. Well, babies, the pastor of Bread of Life, he's backslidden. He's backslidden. And there was just this, like, oh, this darkness that just came over the entire car. And it was like, oh my God. You know, I mean, he might as well have just fallen off into the abyss. It was just, that was when I first became aware of that. I mean, I knew the word, but to know someone who was so, you know, who we thought of as such a pillar of, like, man, this is a pastor who runs a Christian school, and you're telling me that he can just not be saved anymore. And so there was just no worse thing that could happen to you. So now to be a part of a community of people who are, as you said, just having conversations around the trauma that can be passed down through this kind of dogmatic, you know, religious, these experiences is just, I mean, it's just so eye-opening. It's just kind of breaks you open. And it's like, wow, there's so many common experiences that we have. And it really helps you to put the puzzle pieces together. It's like, this isn't just me. Mm-hmm. I'm not just rebellious. I'm not out here just kind of, you know, veering off the path and potentially, you know, getting gobbled up by, you know, dragons or something. Like, this is a thing. Mm-hmm. It's so amazing. And so I think, you know, the TikTok algorithm, it knows you. It starts to figure out who you are and what you're about very soon. So that was not content that I ever sought out. I wasn't really looking for content around that, but obviously it started to feed things to me and it realized, you know, what I was about. And I think I did a video on these what are called tracts, T-R-A-C-T-S, these witnessing tracts that used to be used in our evangelical circles. And they were called chick tracts. And I just did a video on them and kind of talked about the history of them and the person who put them out. And there's really some kind of sinister stuff behind these things. And I think because of that, you know, they realized that, well, I ended up attracting, I think, a lot of the evangelical people, and they just kind of latched onto my content. And I think the other thing I think is because I do a lot of work around kind of anti-racism, because a lot of these people who are deconstructing and who have been in evangelical spaces are also doing work around kind of decolonizing their faith and realizing how much of this, as you said, this white nationalism kind of gets mixed in with evangelical Christianity. I think a lot of them just naturally found my content. So it's been really cool to connect with that community. I participated, I actually helped to organize an online conference called Decon earlier this year, I think. And I was one of the speakers. The topic that I spoke about was called Letting Go of Hell. And so it was all about just how this fear of hell is just drilled into us at a very early age and just, you know, end times and rapture stuff and just how that, you know, kind of thing is used to really instill just a lot of fear, just, you know, not as they say, the fear of God, but just like literal fear into you from an early age. And so, you know, it's been a really liberating thing. I'm sort of out of the closet, I guess, as a deconstructing Christian.
I love it. Yeah, there's so much to that conversation.
Yeah.
When you look at the content, and especially, again, like when we talk about women, because breaking down how a lot of the Western religion really hate women. Like, they really do everything they can to demoralize women and making sure that they are subservient. And of course, there's a giant agenda to that. But to let go of that and realizing that that is misinformation for so many things. Like, there's religion in itself, faith in itself is not the problem necessarily, but what has been made out of it. And so many things that we see that is seeping into our politics today is just unnerving. It is, I guess, right now especially. I know we've been through this before, but it feels like, how are we back here again?
Yeah, you know?
And seeing other people talking about, this is not right. It's always so encouraging to see having someone to uplift that. Hey, this is the other side. Let's look at that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's very encouraging. I mean, as it pertains to so many things, you know, just having a community of people mm-hmm. who help you to know that you're not off the wall. You're not crazy. It's like, right. Yes, I'm seeing what I'm seeing. I'm not the only one who's experiencing this. It's so comforting.
And yeah, to also have, again, because one of the biggest things for me when I walked away from that was losing community. I felt like yes. I lost such a giant part of myself.
Yes.
And that means a big, giant group of people that I considered friends and family. Mm-hmm. So when you walk away from that, you feel so alone. So knowing, yeah. I love that you and then the others have come together to make a community, which makes you feel like, oh, we're together. I'm not right. alone. It's not this where I felt like I got such a huge divorce and I lost right. I lost the main part of everything. It, yeah. it felt like it's such an amazing moment to see that you're being heard and you're being seen.
Yes, it is. That's a huge part of, I think, why a lot of people never really cut those ties. Because it really is, especially for Black folks, you know, that community thing with church. Church has played such a pivotal role historically in the Black community, just in terms of, it's just been a meeting point, you know, a community center kind of environment and town square. And it has substituted for so much with us. And, you know, can still play that role. But I think that there are a lot of people now who are actively addressing some of the more toxic parts of that environment.
Yes. And we would say one of them is you. And throughout, I feel like you've answered this throughout, but you definitely don't shy away in your content from hard questions around race or politics or religion. Why do you think that it's so important that we do address those things and we do talk about those things?
Well, I guess, as we've been saying, just the idea of having a sense of community around these things. I mean, you know, it's to hear someone reinforce something that you already knew in the back of your mind, or to hear someone say it in a way that makes it that allows it to kind of lock in. And I hear that a lot from people. It's like, sometimes people will write me, they will inbox me and say, you know, I can't remember what you were quite saying about this. And I'm having a conversation with my dad about this, or I was trying to tell my friends about this thing that you were saying. And, you know, can you help me to just address this finer point of whatever? And it's like, yeah, here's the information. Or they'll say, your video just, it said it in a way that I couldn't say it. Like, I knew that I felt this way, mm-hmm. but thank you for just hitting this nail head on. And I'm going to send this to my my family who are conservative or whatever. And it's you know, they're oftentimes little bite-sized, you know, 1 minute I've started doing some longer form content, you know, maybe 7 minutes, some of the longer videos are. But like, you know, allowing people to sort of get to home in on exactly what they intend to say or what they already know that they feel about something, but just giving them an organized way to present that information, I think it's really important. I don't really target a lot of my content to diehards that are just dug in on the opposite side of things. Mm-hmm. My content is more geared towards people who are, maybe they're just curious about these topics, or they're on the fence, or, you know, they've been debating with people and they're maybe just mulling things around. And it just kind of helps you lock into the core and the crux of those topics a little bit more securely. I don't really have any interest in debating people who just want to come in with guns blazing. I've moved forward with this process, or, you know, I know that there's no real point. There are some people who just like to argue.
Right.
And that I'm not interested in. So I think, yeah, it's important to have the conversations to kind of help the folks who are interested in doing better, who are interested in learning, who don't necessarily have time to go and read an entire book on anti-racism. Maybe it will encourage them to read a book on anti-racism, but they haven't really taken that step. They haven't really been proactive about it. But like, hey, it comes up in your feed and maybe you're kind of curious about it. And it helps to crystallize some things, you know?
Yeah, that is so valuable. I mean, that's been one of my experiences with podcasting as well. Is sometimes you just need somebody to give voice and words to what it is you're trying to deal with or figure out. So, yes.
Right.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, we couldn't end this interview without talking about your musical career. Yes, you've won so many awards, from Nashville Industry Awards to Grammys. Can you talk about your experience in the music industry?
I don't have a Grammy. I wrote for a Grammy-winning album. I wrote the title track for Keb Mo's. He's a blues singer. He won the Americana Album of the Year for an album called Oklahoma, which is where I'm from, which is why he reached out to me and asked me to co-write the title track with him. So that was a really cool experience. One of the only co-writes that I did when I lived in Nashville. And I just moved away a couple of years ago, first to the New York area, now I'm in Philly. And so, yeah, the crux of my music career was spent in Nashville. And, you know, being a so-called, quote unquote, jazz singer in Nashville is an interesting thing. So it helped me to, I think it helped me to distinguish myself because there are not a ton of jazz singers there. There are plenty. But by the time we left, I really felt like we had done everything that could be done in jazz in Nashville. You know, we had won the awards. The Nashville scene had named me the best jazz singer in Nashville. My husband was the best jazz player in Nashville. So I'm like, okay, you win those awards, you got to get the heck out of Dodge. You don't just keep sitting around waiting for somebody to pat you on the head again. Like, get out and you know, make your career worth something. So there's a lot to be said for being in what I call being up under the spout. You know, physically, the proximity principle is very real. You know, placing yourself in an environment where people are doing the kind of thing that you're doing, and you can be interacting with people who actually have some, you know, the ability to make decisions on your behalf and things like that. So that's the portion of my career that I'm in right now. It's just like I'm getting ready to put out my fifth studio album in June, and it's self-titled Dara Star Tucker. So we'll be putting up the pre-order link for that really soon. So I'm really excited about that process. And we're working with kind of a mid-size or smaller label now called Green Hill Records. And they're really going to help us to kind of get our music into more playlists. And, you know, we're working on getting more placements, you know, with publicity and just getting things up to the next level. I experienced a lot of frustration, I think, just kind of trying to do what I did in Nashville. And I still have a lot of, you know, residual, like, oh God, you know, I should have moved to New York 10 years ago. Why did I not start this process 10 years ago? But it just logistically just did not happen. It could not have happened until it happened. And so I'm just having to accept at this point, it's like, this is how it was supposed to be. It's happening in the way that it needs to happen. And it's really cool now to have a social media following that I do, even though the majority of them don't necessarily follow me for music. But now they're there. And so we're going to talk about music from time to time. They're going to hear about my music, you know, if the algorithm will show it to them. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other issue. Yeah. But, you know, a video for me a few years ago, if I had on Instagram a couple hundred views, that was pretty cool, you know, put up a music video. And so now, you know, I'll get a couple thousand, you know, several, you know, maybe 10,000 views or something, which is not amazing on TikTok or Instagram, but it's exponentially better than it was just a few years ago. So it's really cool, you know. And then so now the process is, how do I merge these personas? How do I merge these identities? How do I make all of this live together, hopefully seamlessly, mm-hmm. and to get a lot of my followers to the point where, you know, like you were saying, Samantha, where you're like, okay, you do this and you do this and you do this. And, you know, I loved this version of this song that you did. And then, you know, your activism thing also, that's the goal now, is just mm-hmm. like, make sure and get the music out to people, because I think there's a continuum between these things. I think that the essence and the core of who I am with these videos, with these video essays, it translates to the music once you hear, I hope that, I mean, and that's probably more for you guys to say versus me, but once you hear me sing, I hope it makes sense that, like, oh, okay, this goes with this. These are like partner things, and it feels like it's coming from the same space, I hope.
Oh, it does. It made perfect sense when you were posting your music. I was like, oh, but also your voice in itself, just you speaking, is very melodious. So I'm like, yeah, of course you can sing, obviously. So like it translated to me in that way.
Thank you.
And you know, because we have to have your expertise outside of your own albums, obviously, for those who are getting into the jazz and blues genre, can you give us like a starter pack for what we should be listening as we go through this?
I love giving music recommendations. in the sort of jazz-ish world, my favorites would be, number one, I would say Gregory Porter. If you don't know who Gregory Porter is, he's just magnificent and wonderful, and there's none greater in terms of his writing and his singing. His original music is really my favorite. I would say someone named Jasmia Horn is one of the just the finest jazz artists that's out there right now. Samara Joy just won the award for Best New Artist and Best Jazz Album. She's one of the more brilliant singers out there. There's a singer called Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, who is so quirky and just original and so interesting, and just she's just incredible. I just love her. And then my fifth recommendation would be a singer named Liz Wright. And she's been out there since the early 2000s, just being absolutely incredible. So those five singers would be my top recommendations for jazz, if you're interested in that. And I don't go, you know, my music doesn't go deep. It's not like a bunch of really complicated jazz solos all over the place. And, you know, some people really, really love that. The music that I do is much more pedestrian. It's really just kind of singer-songwriter stuff that's set to a jazz bed. So it's very vibey and earthy, and you're going to hear real instruments and you are going to hear solos, but it is all very melodic. And I think it's fairly easy to understand. I don't think this stuff is heady and hard to get into. And none of the music that I recommend it is either. So it's for us, I call myself a small brain when it comes to music. I'm not a really, you know, smart, complicated jazz musician at all. I didn't study at a conservatory, and I'm not very good at music theory. So it's music of the people.
You're great at music history, though, I will say that.
Thank you.
But, you know, also this sounds like, because I don't know if you know much about it, I have to talk about it a little bit. I'm starting to get into what's called cozy gaming, in which you try to play cutesy games while you're all cuddled up. That music sounds like it might be right there where I need. So I'm all like comfortable and getting into my good vibes and good states.
Yes.
So I'm going to remember this list, because I think I'm going to need this.
Please do. I really hope you enjoy them. These are some of the most talented people on earth. And I just think they deserve just all of the publicity they could possibly get.
And that's what we need. We want to hear more of that.
Yeah.
And of course, yes, you have talked about your album. So let's get that plug. When is it going to be out? Where do we find it? All those things.
Well, it's going to be, there's actually a link in my bio and social media now where you could theoretically pre-save the album. I have not even talked about it. I haven't put it out there, but it is in my bio. And so it's called Dara Star Tucker. It's self-titled, and it'll be out. I think the release date is June 3rd, but we're going to start releasing singles starting April 7th. And so you'll see me talking about it online. And if you do, just say something, interact with it, share it, something so that the algorithm picks it up, because it can be a challenge to try to get those music posts to get the same kind of, you know, reach as the informational stuff that I do. So that's my challenge now, is just like, how do I find creative ways to share this stuff? And so we'll see going forward whether I can create some visuals that really help people to lock into that. But there's a singer that I really love named Emily King. I don't know if you guys know who she is. I love Emily King. If you don't know who Emily King is, she's not jazz. She's more like the pop R&B, like alt R&B. One of my favorite performers out there, but she's so good with these visuals and helping to get these little grooves and these beats in people's minds, and just creating really interesting ways, you know, in the social media space to share her music. So she's a real inspiration for that. So we're going to see if we can be really creative about the messaging around this album. If you actually see it in your feed, then you'll know we've been somewhat successful with it.
Well, that's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes. Can't wait to check it out.
And we have a tour coming also. So I'll be posting those dates too. Like we're going to be doing album release shows. I'm so sorry to jump in and interrupt. But that all starts in June. Okay. We'll be doing an album release show in my hometown in Tulsa. We'll be doing one in Nashville, where I spent 15 years of my career. We'll be doing one here in New York at Jazz at Lincoln Center. So and here in Philadelphia at South. So all of that stuff I'll be sharing on the socials.
Yes.
Oh, you coming through Atlanta? Because we'll be there if you come through Atlanta.
We're going to try. We book ourselves. So we're still looking for a booking agent to kind of help us to set up some real, you know, true blue tours. But, you know, we would love to come through Atlanta.
Yes. That'd be so cool.
And LA. I think we're coming to LA too. Ooh.
Nice. Well, where can the good listeners find you on these social media to learn about all this stuff?
I am at Dara Star Tucker. Indy Aries tells me to say Dara with one R, S, a star with two. So Dara Star Tucker, D-A-R-A-S-T-A-R-R Tucker. And on most socials, on Instagram, I'm Dara Tucker B. But everywhere else, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, everywhere, I'm Dara Star Tucker.
Yes. So definitely go check that out, listeners. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a delight.
Thank you all for having me. I love having conversations like this with smart people. So thank you for having me.
Yes.
Thank you so pleasure. Much for joining us. This has been amazing.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Anytime. Come back.
I would love it. Yeah. Just let me know if you'd like me to participate in any other conversations. I'm always up for it. If I have the time to do it, I would be up for it. Absolutely.
Awesome. Yes. Awesome. Awesome. Well, listeners, definitely go check out Dara Star Tucker if you have not already. If you would like to contact us, you can. Our email is Stephanie at MomStuff at iHeartMedia.com. You can find us on Twitter at MomStuff Podcast or on Instagram and TikTok at Stuff I Never Told You and on YouTube also. Thanks as always to our super producer, Christina, our executive producer, Maya, and our contributor, Joey.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. And thanks to you for listening. Stuff I Never Told You is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics, in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.